Blog Talk Radio.
Archangels, ghosts, and Bigfoot. Oh my! It's just another night for Supernatural Girls. Real stories, real answers to life's biggest supernatural mysteries. And now for another exciting interview with paranormal experts from this world and others. Psychic medium Helene Olson and paranormal researcher Patricia Baker. Here are Supernatural Girls.
Everybody to Supernatural Girls. I am your host this evening, Patricia Baker, and today is June 29th, 2013. And I will be your only host this evening because Helene is unable to join us. She's had quite a busy week, very exciting and not so great in so many ways, but her husband has been in the hospital, and I have the good news to report, which is he's doing much better. And I want to thank you all for all the prayers that were sent, all the good wishes that obviously had a wonderful and powerful effect. So the other thing that Helene is getting ready for, on top of everything she had to do this week, is a psychic fair. And that's going to be happening in Hyannis, Massachusetts, which is on the Cape, the Hyannis Green, and that's going to be happening from 12 to 8. Tomorrow, Sunday. So if you're in the area, please stop by and say hello to Helene. She would love to say hello and meet you. And she's going to be offering energy circles every hour. And she also has a table that's going to be filled with incredibly beautiful bracelets, necklaces, charms, and they're all energetically charged. And there's also a new product that we are both introducing called Divine Right, which are edible mystically charged wafers in an alabaster bowl. You've got to check them out. They're very, very cool. So anyways, go over and if you're in Hyannis, stop by, say hello to Helene and her assistants, Alex and Cheryl. It's going to be a fun day for everybody there in Hyannis. So feel free to stop in. And there's no admission charge. That's the best part of all. So tonight we are doing a health show. And as you know, we've been doing a health show once a month. These are always the best leading-edge guests that are talking about very important health issues. And tonight we are really, really lucky to have Dr. Garth Nicholson joining us. He is an amazing, amazing man, very brave man, who has just done a tremendous amount of work in the field of the Gulf War syndrome, autoimmune disease, vaccinations. We're going to be talking about all of these things tonight, and I'm just going to go right into introducing Dr. Nicholson a little bit to you because he is so well-known in his field, but I want you to know about him as well. We're not going to go into paranormal news because this is such an important topic, and I want to make sure that we have every minute we possibly can to answer questions and talk to people in the audience that may have something to share or a question they need answered about autoimmune disease and vaccinations. These are really important things today. So Dr. Nicholson is the President and Chief Scientific Officer and Research Professor at the Institute for Molecular Medicine in Huntington Beach, California. And Dr. Nicholson received his B.S. in Chemistry at the University of California, Los Angeles in 1965, his Ph.D. in Biochemistry and Cell Biology from the University of California at San Diego in 1970. He is currently Professor of Integrative Medicine at California University of Integrative Medicine and a Conjoint Professor at the University of Newcastle in Australia. And again, I could just keep reading throughout the entire 2 hours here. I mean, this Dr. Nicholson is very, very well known in this field, very esteemed professor, scientist, and he is among the most cited scientists in the world. He has published over 550 medical scientific papers, including 3 contents citation classics. Edited books, served on the editorial boards of 20 medical and scientific journals. If you have a question that you want to ask on autoimmune disease, Gulf War syndrome, this is the person you need to ask. And so I'm going to bring him on because we have so much to talk about this evening. So just let's see here. Let me introduce Dr. Nicholson. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be on your program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know you just returned from Australia, right?
That's correct.
And you teach there. That's another place where you have a professorship role.
Well, I just got back from Newcastle University, and yes, I gave some lectures there. I have a joint appointment there, and I've had that for several years now. So it's fun to travel down under and see my colleagues and friends.
Well, that's wonderful. It's nice you get to make, but that's a long trip. How many hours is that from California?
Well, it's about at least a 16-hour trip, and I had to go to Melbourne, which is even further because it's the very bottom of Australia, because I had to give the keynote address at the World Congress of Natural Medicine that was taking place there early June.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I hope that you're well-rested and, again, from your long flight and being in lovely Australia. Is it winter there now, or what is it?
It's beginning of winter there now. It's not deep into winter, but it was chilly in Melbourne, but I did go up further north, and by the time I got to Newcastle, the weather was fabulous.
Oh, thank goodness. Well, that's good. That's good. So let's start at the beginning. 1980, I believe, is when this mycoplasma was weaponized, and if you could start with the story, because there is so much to this entire subject, but I'd like to have you give people a perspective on what happened in that small town in Texas and how that all began.
Well, that actually began a bit after our experience with veterans of the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. In fact, our stepdaughter was one of those veterans, and that's how we got involved. It was a family matter. She came back from the Gulf War. She had been a crew chief on a Black Hawk helicopter in the 101st Airborne Division. They were deployed deep in Iraq during the conflict. She came back, was training to be a pilot, but her health failed, and she had to leave the Army. It worked out fine for her because eventually she went on to medical school, and she's now a practicing neurologist in the Chicago area. But it didn't work out well for a lot of other people. In fact, about 250,000 veterans who became ill to various illnesses from the first Gulf War. And we were primarily concerned with the illnesses that spread to immediate family members. So we had situations where family members were getting sick after the veteran returned. The spouses were getting sick first, and they had a chronic fatigue syndrome-like illness. And then the children were becoming autistic in these families.
So we knew
we had a major problem that we were having to deal with, and so we started trying to figure out what was wrong, and eventually we found that it was an infection, because infection is the only thing that you can really pass to your family members after you get back. You can't pass in environmental exposures, like exposures to, let's say, poisonous gas or to oil fires or something like that, chemical exposures. You can't really pass that to immediate family members, so not everyone who served and came down ill had this particular problem, but at least half of the ones that were sick had a problem where they were passing their illness to their family members. So we knew it had to be biological. So then trying to figure out what it was a long, difficult road, because their symptoms were complex. They had so many different signs and symptoms. Some of them had 30 or 40 different signs and symptoms. So we had to slowly rule out one by one the types of infections that were involved. And we knew they weren't acute infections. They didn't have a rapid onset. They had a very slow onset. They had a peculiar set of problems associated with them, including some of them complained a lot about digestive problems, arthritic problems, muscle aches and pains, headaches, brain fog, cognitive loss, and so on and so forth. So they had a number of different problems.
And what were they doing? They were going to the VA hospitals, and they were, from what I understand, they were being told it was all in their head. Is that correct?
But at that time, they were. They were being told that they were essentially suffering from a psychological illness, not really a medical problem. But we worked with special forces and highly trained personnel, and we knew that they weren't prone to these psychological problems, and it had to be a real illness, particularly the groups of people we were really working with, the veterans that we were working with directly, and their family members as well. So we started one by one ruling out various things, and finally we found out that a lot of them were infected with a very unusual bacterium called a mycoplasma. This is a type of bacterium that does not have a rigid cell wall, so it has to get inside your, has to burrow inside your cells in order to survive and divide. When it hides inside your cells, it causes a number of different problems, and it can get into the central nervous system, for example, and other places around your body, and really wreak havoc, and it can set up an autoimmune disease situation and a lot of other medical problems that I won't go into. But what we found was that we could actually treat this type of infection, and a lot of the people that were infected, it slowly began to recover, but it took a year or so of treatment before they really, really recovered. But we thought we really had something, so we started investigating the family members, and we found out they had the same infection. We could treat the family members, even the children, and eventually they would recover. But this led us on a whole new pathway because illnesses like this exist in the civilian sector as well. And up until now, they'd basically been undiagnosable. They'd been given various vague diagnoses like chronic fatigue syndrome, or in children, for example, they had behavioral disorders like autism, autism spectrum disorders, and so on. And nobody knew the cause of these, and most of these people were really not given adequate treatments and never really recovered. So we were finally able to treat a lot of these people and allow them to recover their lives. And so that's the story. But
now, how
the story
did you treat
goes
them?
Further back than that, because
oh, it does.
When
yeah.
we were yes, because when I was in Texas and I was serving down there, I was a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at the University of Texas in Houston, and I was also at the MD Anderson Cancer Center there. We were seeing a lot of people that were coming in from the civilian sector that had all these unusual problems. And in particular, we got messages from very specific places in Texas because they'd heard of our work with Gulf War veterans, and they said, you know, we have a lot of people in this town that have exactly that same problem, and we need help. And it's interesting that the areas that had the most problems were areas where they had prisons located. So in some towns in Texas, they'd place these prisons to help the unemployment problems. And most of the people in the town, mostly 60 or 70% of them, worked at a prison, for example, in these small towns. And they were having a tremendous problem with this, and the guards were getting sick, and let alone what was going on in the prisons, which I won't really discuss. But we worked with the guards, and then their family members were getting sick, just like the veterans. And we started testing them, and lo and behold, we found that they had the same problem. They had the same type of infection that we found in the veterans, only this had been going on for years before the Gulf War. This had been going on since the early to middle 1980s, and the illnesses had spread in the community and were just overwhelming some of these communities. So we knew that this was something very peculiar because it existed before the Gulf War. It didn't just pop up then. And it existed in under unusual circumstances in these communities where they had prisons. And a lot of the people were sick. In fact, most of them were connected with the prison one way or the other, the prison system.
So basically, we have more than one town that's affected. I thought it was just one. But what you're saying, it was anywhere that they had these prisons where they were testing this particular mycoplasma on the prisoners, this head was spreading way outside the confines.
We didn't know at the time that they were actually testing on the prisoners. Actually, some of the people that worked in the prison systems dug that out later. They actually went and found some of the transcripts of the meetings of the prison board, and they tried to hide these. And in fact, they tried to destroy all the copies of these meetings. But they did. They forgot one set of copies in a basement in Austin, the capital, and they found the copies of the actual board meetings where they approved for these experiments in the prison system that were being conducted for the Army, and they were vaccine testing experiments. So that was one of the first clues that we might trace this back to the vaccine. But at the same time, there were other things coming out from the Gulf War that were very interesting, where some of the soldiers that were deployed, but they were deployed too quickly to get vaccinations, because most of the veterans that served received as much 20 to 30 different vaccines within a three-day period during their deployment. But the war happened so quickly when they brought in some of the reserve personnel that they didn't receive all these vaccines, and those people didn't get sick from the Gulf War.
Oh, so
then we had another group
that didn't have the vaccines didn't get sick.
No, and then we had another group that were vaccinated but were never deployed. They thought they were going to be deployed, but the war ended too soon, so they ended up not being deployed. And many of those also became sick, but not at the same high frequency that we found with the Gulf War veterans, where about 18% of the deployed personnel became sick with a variety of these illnesses. Now, not everybody had the infection. We found about half of them did, the ones that became sick. But even in the personnel that were not deployed but received the vaccines, some of those that became sick, they also had the infection. So the infection was likely from the military vaccines that they received during deployment. And that was a huge problem in itself. But then going back to what was going on in the prison system, those were vaccine experiments. They were actually testing vaccines in the early to mid-80s in the prison systems in Texas. And they actually found in some of the prison records where they had approval for testing mycoplasma vaccines. So it was pretty likely that this was what was going on, not only in the prison system, and that's why the reason the populations in these towns were getting sick with these mycoplasmal infections, but we found such a high frequency of mycoplasma infections in the sick Gulf War veterans and their family members, because they slowly passed it to their family members when they came back if they had this particular infection. So it began to look like this was something in the vaccines, that this was a problem with the military vaccines, and it was a problem actually that they knew about, because it was a problem that they had found in the testing in the prison system in Texas. So that's part of the controversy of this. They tried to do everything to shut us up, to try and discredit us, to try and get me fired from my position, for example. And this is all discussed in our book, Project Daylily, and I urge your readers to...
Which is a great book, by the way, and it's available on Amazon.com, and I highly recommend it to everybody in our audience, because... both you and your wife, Nancy, who's also a microbiologist, correct?
That's correct.
A microbiologist. And she was right there in the trenches with you through all of this, and you both had attempts on your lives as a result of being whistleblowers in this whole big mess.
Well, it's all discussed in our book, Project Daylily, and your readers could actually read the first chapter online. We have a website for it. It's called ProjectDaylily.com, and it's Daylily is, it's all spelled as one word, ProjectDaylily.com.
So it's DaylilyY.com. And again,
right.
It's a fascinating book. I couldn't put it down because you both really did an excellent job writing it. And again, it's a true story, even though you wrote it more or less as a novel. But this is what really happened to you both.
Well, we had to write it really as a novel, because when we were first shopping the book around, none of the major publishing houses would touch it. I don't know if they were informed, but they wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. So we redid it as a novel so that we could bring in elements that weren't, we didn't have all the evidence for, but they were substantial pieces of information, and we could bring it all together in a novel and make it easier to read and make it more enjoyable to read that way.
Well,
and
it really
also,
is
we wouldn't have to worry
book.
About lawsuits.
Yeah,
we wouldn't have to worry about lawsuits.
Well, that's it. You know, here you are. You're trying to tell the truth about something, but your lives are being threatened, and at the same time, I mean, you look at all of what whistleblowers go through, and that's certainly a frightening experience. It's unfortunate that this is what happens in our society today, but the people like you and your wife, who are brave souls and want to bring us all the truth about this, often face a very rough road. And I can't personally thank you enough, as well as so many other people, for the work that you're doing and trying to get to the bottom of all of this and offer all of us some type of treatment and cure that makes sense. But I do have a question. I mean, you're talking about identifying the infection that these people had in the towns and also the people that had been deployed. How did you find it? I mean, is this through testing blood in the lab that you were looking for a specific thing? How did you discover this? Sounds like it was fairly
hidden.
This
is all spelled out in the book, but let me just briefly go through this. The first thing that we did was we assembled a gigantic spreadsheet of all the signs and symptoms, and then we compared this to what types of infections, because at that time we knew it had to be an infection, would cause a particular set of signs and symptoms. And then one by one, we went through those types of infections through testing, blood testing, to see who had it and who didn't have this type of infection. And that's how we settled on at least half the people having this mycoplasmal infection. Now, there were some other infections that we found as well, but nowhere near the incidence that we found for the mycoplasma. So that was unusually high.
Now, there's over 200 different kinds of mycoplasma, and so you were able to narrow this down to a certain type of mycoplasma infection?
Yes, that was the interesting part of it as well, is that we found only one type, at least in 85% or more of the cases. It was just one species of mycoplasma out of the 200. So that really suggests that there was something very, very specific going on, that it wasn't a random event, random infection. And it turns out that this one type of infection, it's called Mycoplasma fermentans, is also the culprit in Lyme disease, for example. 70-75% of Lyme patients also have the same type of mycoplasma. People don't realize that, but it's an unusual situation. And it's so unusual that this particular species of mycoplasma, which was relatively unheard of 20 years ago, has now become very prominent, at least in North America. But if you look at, for example, chronic fatigue syndrome patients, they often have a number of other different species of mycoplasma. It's still a very common infection in these patients. But if you look at, let's say, European patients with the chronic fatigue syndrome, the most common mycoplasma there is not Mycoplasma fermentans, it's another one, Mycoplasma hominis. And so this is something that's fairly unique to North America, fairly unique to military personnel that served in the first Gulf War, for example. It's fairly unique to autistic children in North America compared to other places. So this is something that we have here in North America that's I wouldn't say it's entirely unique, because it is found in other places, but it's less common in those other sites around the world compared to North America. But you do see other types of similar infections. For example, I was just in Australia, and down there they have their own set of infections that are very commonly found in, for example, chronic fatigue syndrome or autoimmune diseases. And it's not necessarily the same types that we see in North America, and that's a bit different from what we see in Europe. So there are regional differences around the world in these infections, but they are still very commonly found in people with a variety of chronic illnesses. And in fact, I published reviews on this in major medical journals, like the British Journal of Medical Practitioners, for example. I published a large two-part review on the role of these infections in neurodegenerative and neurobehavioral diseases. So autism, for example, is a neurobehavioral disease, but there are a variety of neurodegenerative diseases, like Lou Gehrig's disease, for example, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which used to be an unusual neurologic disease, but now has become much more common. And we were seeing this at very high incidence in these Gulf War veterans. And these were very young people. These were aged less than 25. And this is a middle-aged onset disease. It's extremely rare to see it in an individual aged less than 25. But yet here we had these very young people who served in the Gulf War who were coming down with ALS. And so we examined them, and 100% of them had this infection. And we examined British veterans with ALS, Canadian, Australian, and American veterans. And they all had this infection. So that was something that was very unusual, and I'm not sure whether neurologists even believe it even now, even though we've published the results in a very prestigious medical journal. It's just something that they weren't familiar with, and they didn't really expect to see an infection in this type of process. But in the meantime, we started to look at other neurodegenerative diseases, multiple sclerosis, for example, Alzheimer's disease, and so on. And again, you find a very high incidence of mycoplasmal infections in these diseases. So this is something that all of a sudden we're seeing all over the place, and I think the reason for that is that nobody ever looked before. That's one reason. The second thing is this is an emerging infection. This is something that wasn't around at high incidence 20, 30 years ago, but now all of a sudden has become more and more prominent. It's sort of penetrated into the population without anybody realizing it was there. And now, in retrospect, we should have been more diligent earlier on in looking for these types of infections in various types of disease conditions, particularly those that were increasing at incidence that you couldn't really explain. Something like ALS, for example, you couldn't really explain the increasing incidence rates, you know, on the basis of genetics or the basis of anything. So it had to be either environmental or infective or some other reason. And that's exactly what we found, is that there was an infective process involved in this. So even when we looked at civilians with ALS, we do see a very high incidence of this type of infection. In that case, it drops down to about 80%, so there are other potential problems as well. But that's still a very high incidence of this infection in civilians.
Well, it is a very high incidence. But here's the problem that I'm seeing, and as you know, I have an autoimmune disease. I have systemic scleroderma, and what I find with so many physicians is that they don't even want to consider this infective reality. They don't even want to talk to you about it. They're just so busy handing out anti-inflammatory drugs, and if you bring this issue to their attention, most of them just look at you like you have two heads.
Well, that's unfortunately the problem of their training. Now, I taught medical school for over 30 years. I'm retired now, but I taught many a medical student, and this was something that was not really taught in medical school. If it was taught, it was just glossed over very quickly. It was not really part of the examination systems that you take as a medical student or to qualify and become a board-certified physician, for example. So it's out of the realm of most physicians' training, and so if it's out of the realm of most physicians' training, then very few of them actually go back and pick up where their training left off to learn new things about medicine, and that's the problem that we face, is that many of them have never heard of it. I think more have heard of it now because of all the, not only the publicity about it, but the publications. We've published a lot of publications in this area, and it's beginning to have an effect. It's been a very slow effect, but it's beginning to have an effect. I've gone around the world speaking on this topic to medical audiences. For example, I was in Australia speaking to naturopathic physicians there. Well, the naturopathic physicians are a little more open-minded about things like this, about unusual problems and unusual things than your normal physician. But still, they were in many cases, had not heard about it yet. And so it's, again, a very slow process of education.
It is. And I also think it's really important for people who have these illnesses to go to your website, which is imed.org, and read the articles that you have there, read the literature that's posted, so that you can go to your doctor and bring this information with you. And I think you have to be your own best advocate, because if you just hand your health over to your physician, you're not going to be happy with the result, more than likely. So,
well, just ask any Lyme patient. Just ask any Lyme disease patient that question, because you know, here's a problem of a multiple infection disease process. Because the Lyme patients have not only the Lyme Borrelia, which is the most famous of the infections, but they also have a host of other infections which are causing them problems, including the mycoplasma that I was just discussing. They also have problems with Bartonella, Babesia, Ehrlichia, and a number of other possible infections, but those are the most common, along with the Borrelia and the mycoplasma, in the Lyme disease constellation of infections. And most physicians have enough trouble dealing with Borrelia, let alone all the other infections. So when a person shows up and has not only Lyme Borrelia, but all these other infections as well, that most physicians are just overwhelmed. They don't know how to treat this complex infectious disease process, and it's just overwhelming to them. It's extremely difficult to treat. And we've been working actually with some Lyme experts, like Richard Horowitz, for example, a very well-known internist who practices out of Hyde Park, New York. And he just wrote a long book on this, and he devoted a certain amount of the book to this particular topic, dealing with things like mycoplasma and the other co-infections in Lyme disease and how difficult they are to treat. And so their whole organizations, like the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, that have sprung up just really based on the fact that Lyme is so difficult to treat, and there's all these different infections, and what are they, and how do you deal with the patients that present with all these different infections? And these are very difficult patients to treat. And most people with Lyme have had the disease for quite a while, and they really have suffered without resolution of their problems. And so this is a major topic of interest of mine and of a lot of other people these days.
And well, it should be, because there are so many people afflicted with this, and as you mentioned, a lot of them are not getting any relief. So it's the kind of disease that you can limp along, and it'll really take the quality of life right away from you. And you start to feel hopeless with a Lyme infection. But what we're going to do is we're going to take a break in just for a minute, a couple of minutes. We'll come right back, and we're going to talk about treatment. We're going to take some questions and continue this fascinating conversation. So everybody that's listening, if you have a question for Dr. Nicholson, please call 646-478-0828. Again, that's 646-478-0828. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Your property tax bill. Have you seen it lately? It's frightening. Your property taxes are going up while your home value is going down. It's time to fight back and win. For the real truth about the property tax system, get attorney Pat Quintilian's book, Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Attorney Quintilian answers all your questions and gives you the facts you need to fight a property tax bill that is spiraling out of control. You'll also read about what happens to property owners who don't check their property records, only to find out too late they're taxed on square footage, fixtures, and even buildings that they don't own. Is this happening to you? Learn your rights. Buy Attorney Pat Quintilian's book today. Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Available on Amazon.com.
Sometimes life can be a challenge. Would you like insight and guidance to help you make the best choices right now? Contact Helene at angelslighthouse.com to make your personal appointment for a psychic reading or energy alignment. Helene is a direct channel to the angelic realm and is remarkably capable of connecting to the living as well as to your loved ones on the other side. Helene is available to clients all over the world via phone or Skype, and it's simple to set up a group reading anywhere. Visit angelslighthouse.com, where you'll find an easy way to schedule right online. And while you're there, sign up for the Angels Lighthouse newsletter and receive information on all the free energy circles, giveaways, and jewelry with a message. Visit angelslighthouse.com and contact Helene today.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for staying tuned. We are speaking with Dr. Garth Nicholson about autoimmune disease, Gulf War syndrome, and vaccinations. If you have a question, please call 646-478-0828. That's 646-478-0828. So, Dr. Nicholson, we were talking about Lyme disease and all of the co-infections, the constellation of infections that are involved. It does sound overwhelming when you start mentioning all of them. There's quite a few.
There are quite a few infections in these Lyme patients, and that is one of the difficulties in treating them. Also, these infections are inside our cells. They're intracellular, for the most part, bacterial infections, and they're difficult to treat. And this really requires some heavy-duty treatment, but also some natural treatments as well. And we prefer to do both. We're not biased in any way. We just want to see what gives the best results. And so later on in your program, I want to talk about some of the natural developments in natural medicine that we've been involved in that help people with virtually any chronic illness, or even people that are getting older and losing function and becoming fatigued and so on. So that's something that we've been really concentrating on lately, and this is one of the major topics that I spoke about in Australia when I was there to the Naturopathic Physician Society there. So this is something I think that's important for people to realize and to know about, because it's something they can do themselves. They don't need their physician to actually, you know, do some of this natural medicine, and I think it's really important that people know about it.
I do, too. I mean, it is so important if the patient can take some of this power into their own hands with lifestyle choices or purchasing certain supplements and things like that, so that it will increase their chances of recovery. Because all of these illnesses are just devastating. I talk to so many people every week who feel that their lives have just been taken away from them by these horrible diseases. A lot of these diseases don't kill them, but it makes their lives so miserable.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's probably one of the reasons they haven't received the attention that they should receive. But there are a lot of illnesses that have these infections as an important cofactor, and that includes HIV/AIDS, for example, Lyme disease, various autoimmune diseases. We've worked a lot with arthritis patients, but other autoimmune disorders are equally important, neurodegenerative diseases, a variety of different bowel disorders and bowel diseases. Besides the neurodegenerative diseases that I mentioned earlier in the program and the neurobehavioral diseases, there are just a whole host of other chronic illnesses where these types of infections are involved in a very important way. And they probably help to explain the increasing incidence of these diseases that you just wouldn't expect. For example, autoimmune diseases, or the frequency that these are increasing, you just wouldn't expect it from our community. There's got to be something else going on. And one of the things that's going on are these chronic infections. There are other things as well, the contamination of the environment and so on, that also impact upon these illnesses. But the infections are something that we can actually find and do something about.
Well, again, why are these diseases skyrocketing? Because they are. I mean, the numbers are just going up exponentially. And you can compare them to heart disease and cancer, and they're way above those numbers. So what is causing this?
Well, one of the problems are these emerging infections, these new infections that people don't test for and they don't know about. They creep into the population and they just slowly spread without people realizing that they're there and without realizing their involvement in these various diseases. And that's one of the things that we've worked on. Environmental deterioration is another aspect of this, which I think is very important as well, and largely not focused on by the medical establishment. We focused on the infections because it is something that we can test for, we can find, we can do something about, although the treatments are not easy. These things are involved in a whole host of different problems, and I'll just direct people to our website again if they're interested in this. They're actually, you can go on the website and you can click on a certain button that says Signs and Symptoms, and you can go through this and do a survey of your own signs and symptoms if you have a chronic illness and see if that relates to, for example, the fact you might have one of these chronic infections. And then on the website, it discusses a number of different scenarios, for example, like autoimmune diseases or neurodegenerative diseases or chronic fatiguing illnesses and so on. And it's amazing how many people in our population, in our society today, have these different problems, and they're not getting adequate treatment for it. They're receiving care from a traditionally trained physician who really doesn't realize the full extent of the role of these infections and other environmental problems in these illnesses. And so they're not receiving adequate treatment, and they're not recovering from their illnesses. They just go on, and they're sick for year after year after year and not getting better. And that's something that we need to do something about.
Well, absolutely. And isn't it also true that the longer that you go on in a chronic illness like that, the less chance there is for full recovery?
Well, it becomes harder. I don't know about the... Well, the chances are still good that you recover. It's just a much more difficult problem, and it takes a Herculean effort if somebody's been sick for a long period of time and they have very severe signs and symptoms. But people that have had a variety of different diagnoses tend to collect these different infections over time as well, because their immune systems are compromised, and it makes them more susceptible to these infections. And since people don't know a lot about these infections anyway, they tend to spread very slowly in the population. And once people pick these infections up, they don't know about it, and they could have them for years. And if they're untreated for years, it's a severe problem.
And undiagnosed for years. I mean, it took me 5 years to get a diagnosis. I went to a rheumatologist, and I said, "This is what I have." And he said, "No, you don't." And I said, "Okay, what is it?" "Well, it's a nonspecific autoimmune disease." So, and I have heard the same story from so many people, where just to get a proper diagnosis takes many years. So right away, you're working from behind the eight ball, because you can't get the right diagnosis. And so any hope of any treatment is delayed because you have this nonspecific diagnosis. Believe me, I didn't want to believe I was right either. I mean, having a diagnosis like I had, I wasn't thrilled that I was right. But it annoyed me greatly that the doctor was so unwilling to consider what I was saying and really looked down his nose at me and like, "Well, who are you? What do you know? I'm the patient. I know probably more than you do."
Millions of Americans are
this.
Exactly in that same situation as you found yourself, because their physicians are really unwilling to consider the alternatives. And again, part of that goes back to their training, their original training in medical school. Some of them just have not progressed beyond that.
Well, they haven't. And again, the other thing I look at is who's funding the research. And the drug companies tend to make a lot more money with pain pills and other things. I mean, let's face it, they want customers. So, you know, you can have a bunch of customers who are constantly buying medications that are not going to make you well, but they're just going to alleviate some of your symptoms. So is there, you know, we have to look at that as well. The pharmaceutical companies as a big business who are there to make money. They're not there to cure me necessarily, to offer me one pill that's going to make all the difference in the world. So we have to be very realistic, I think, as a population, and start taking more of these things into our own hands, reading your website, which is imed.org, I-M-M-E-D.org, reading your book, Project Daylily, and really informing ourselves as to what our choices are and where this whole thing got started, where this whole thing came from, because I do want to go back to that. I know we've kind of touched on that a little bit, but that whole process of the vaccinations that were being tested on prisoners in Texas, that was the beginning of weaponized mycoplasma, wasn't it?
Well, we're not sure, but that's certainly one of the earlier points that we can look at, where we know what period of time was involved. We have some documents from the prison board indicating, you know, the approval for these tests, what the tests were, where they were being conducted, types of things that were involved, at least in a fairly vague way. We knew what happened there, and we can see the outcome. We can see the outcome not only in the prison guards and their family members, but in the communities where these infections have penetrated and caused devastating illnesses in the communities, and where there's a huge spike in autoimmune diseases and chronic fatiguing illnesses, neurodegenerative diseases, diabetes, all sorts of different chronic conditions, and it all correlates to going back to when these infections got loose in the prison systems and were brought into the community by basically the prison employees.
Yes, exactly. And as I believe you mentioned numerous times in your book and also in your lectures, that once something like this is released, there's no controlling it. You can't really stop it.
Well, you can only really stop it if you can identify it and treat the people who are infected. And that's exactly what did not happen. And these penetrated so badly that, and they caused so much impact on a variety of other diseases. When I was at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, for example, we did a study on breast cancer and ovarian cancer patients because we were seeing such a high mortality rate of these patients. Their diseases were progressing very rapidly, particularly if they were from these regions in East Texas or South Texas where these prisons were located. And these patients were dying very quickly of their disease, and it turns out they were infected with these unusual infections as well, and they promoted the progression of their cancers. So here's something having a very dramatic effect on a variety of disease processes, and just completely unheard of, completely ignored, and unfortunately those people that picked up these infections and had cancers died very quickly of the combination of the infection and the cancer. And we now know the reason for that is that they caused the progression, the very rapid progression of their disease, of their cancers, and that's what really killed them. But maybe without the infections, or if the infections were adequately treated, those people would be alive today. We don't know. But it was certainly a major problem that has not gone away.
It's frightening. It really is. And so what you're saying is that if some of these people obviously had cancer, and then with the coupling of these mycoplasma infections, it spread like wildfire. It just basically set fire to the disease, and it just rampaged them. And
well, we know what happened in those cases, or we think we know what happened, because the mycoplasma that we've studied gets inside our cells, and it stimulates the release of oxidative compounds inside the cells called reactive oxygen species. These damage the DNA, they damage the membranes of the cell. That's one reason why these infections are so devastating in the neurodegenerative diseases, because they damage the nerve cell membranes. But they also damage the DNA inside the cells. And if it turns out to be a cancer cell, this can damage the DNA and make it worse. It can make the cells more unstable, and if they're cancer cells, they can grow more wildly. They can spread and metastasize because it promotes that process of progression. So that's one of the things that we found that was just absolutely amazing to see it happen before your very eyes.
And that is
not
amazing.
Be able to do much about it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, I do have a question in the chat room. Somebody's asking, how do you test for mycoplasma? Is there a way, if a person suspects they have this type of infection, how do you test for it?
Well, there are a small number of laboratories, for example, in North America and Europe, that do molecular testing for these types of infections. The information we have on our websites is not quite up to date, so I'm going to tell people to send me an email. And my email address is on our website, which is, again, it's immed.org. And just go to the website, go under staff, send me an email. I'll be glad to send you information on the testing laboratories. But there's one in Texas, for example. There's one in California. There's one back east. So there are a few laboratories that can test for these infections, but not that many.
No, there aren't, and it's something people need to know, because this is not something you could go down to your local lab, Quest Lab or whatever it is, and just have this done. It sounds like this is a very specialized testing, and they'd have to request that. Is that correct?
It is specialized testing. It is, and it usually requires a blood test, and the samples have to be sent in an appropriate way so that the test isn't a false negative test because of the handling of the samples. So there are a number of peculiar things that have to be taken care of in terms of getting these tested. But routine laboratory tests are not going to pick it up.
That's the thing. I mean, so, you know, what are we testing for? I mean, it seems like a lot of what these regular laboratory tests are providing is just useless information. Because if this mycoplasma is behind so many different things, it sounds like it's one of the most important things that patients and doctors should be searching for.
Well, it does impact on a variety of different diseases. I just got an email from a respiratory physician in Ohio who's seen a lot of cases of people with chronic pulmonary problems, for example, and not only chronic pulmonary diseases, but also chronic inflammatory bowel airway diseases and so on. And they have a huge incidence of that in certain areas, and it's not all just because of pollution. This physician is finding a very high incidence of mycoplasma infection in these patients, and it's something that was never really considered before, that this could play an important role in airway diseases, but it does in many patients.
Yeah, I remember interviewing someone about pulmonary hypertension, and I believe until recently there was no treatment for that. Is that accurate?
Well, again, it depends on the underlying problem, and these problems are generally they're complex. They involve around a number of different situations of environmental effects, for example, in this case, infection and genetic factors and so on and so forth. So these diseases are complex, like many other diseases. For example, people that have chronic inflammatory bowel problems, another area where we're finding these mycoplasmal and other infections to be present at very high incidence. And those people also have a tremendous problem finding physicians that know how to treat the infections that are associated with their condition.
So you're also saying that IBS is also, that mycoplasma could be contributing to that as well.
It could be in many patients, that we found. But again, there are a variety of different inflammatory and autoimmune disease processes that are associated with these types of infections. And years ago, we were asking ourselves, why is this so? What is it unique about this type of infection? And it turns out not only this, but other intracellular infections that get inside our cells, and then if they're released from the cells, they often take a piece of the membrane of the cell, the host, with them, and then the immune system recognizes the pathogen, and it mounts a response against that, but it also sees these normal antigens associated with the pathogen, and it responds against those too, thinking they're part of the pathogen, and that results in an autoimmune attack on the cells that contain the infection as well. So this is one of the things that we found that happens that may help explain why there's such a high incidence of these infections in autoimmune patients.
Well, and that's another question that I just saw come out in the chat room. Is it really that the immune system is attacking itself, or is the immune system attacking infected tissue?
Well, this is a question that comes up over and over again, and we really don't have, it's a chicken and egg type of question. We don't have the answer for it, but we do know that if the infections are treated effectively, that this can reduce the problem. It can reduce the signs and symptoms. It may not make them go away entirely, but it certainly offers relief to patients that have seen nothing that would relieve their problems except complete suppression of their immune system, and that just results in further problems and leaves them wide open for a variety of other infections, and that's not something that we like to see.
Absolutely. I know there was a Scott trial just in the last couple of years that they did throughout the country where they devastate the immune system and then bring in new stem cells. But, again, this doesn't even make sense to me to do a big treatment like that has more destructive power than regenerative power. That's what it looks like. As a patient and as a person who knows enough about medicine to be dangerous, I look at that kind of thing and just shake my head. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, it certainly doesn't make any sense if there are infections involved, because suppressing the immune system completely, the infections just go wild. And then even if you're given a new stem cell load, they still haven't addressed the problem of the infection, and you're not going to be likely to overcome the disease situation, even with new stem cells, if infection is not addressed.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've spoken to a lot of people that have had stem cell treatment in California, and they have had a relief of symptoms that goes between 3 to 5 months. But after that, just as you mentioned, the infection hasn't been treated, so guess what? The symptoms start to slowly return because the infection's still doing its thing. So it's nice to have that 3 to 5 month break where you're not overwhelmed with all of these horrible symptoms. But at the same time, if they could be treated for the infection first, then have the stem cell, or vice versa. But something has to happen to treat that infection. And that seems to be the biggest missing piece in every single treatment protocol except yours.
Well, it is a major problem, and it's not only is it difficult to overcome in the patient situation, but it's also, as we were discussing, it's difficult to overcome the physician block to this type of thinking. But it's there if they bother to look at it, if they bother to really address the problem. It's there, and it won't go away. And all the wishful thinking and all the hand-waving and all the other things, all the other antics is not going to make it better.
That's for sure. Now, you mentioned cancer earlier and how this could really speed that whole process of cancer cells along. What about just general cancer treatment? This is something that you would recommend people get tested for mycoplasma infection?
Well, particularly if they have a rapidly evolving cancer, one that they've already detected metastases in, for example, or detected spread of the cancer. Also, people that are considered high risk because of a number of other reasons from their diagnostic workup, they should probably check to see if they have these infections, because if the infections aren't treated, it may come back, and it may come back with a vengeance.
Exactly. And that's, I think, what some people see. I mean, again, you talk about when you look at the breakdown of the immune system, that happens in treatment quite a bit for cancer patients. And then they go back in for the stem cell. But, I mean, some people I'm seeing are just, they're not making it to that next level for the stem cell treatment because, again, as you mentioned, these infections are now going wild. They have nothing to stop them in the body because the entire immune system has been compromised on purpose.
Yes, and again, in the autoimmune problems, you see the same thing as well. Is it you see that gap from the treatment to the relapse, and that seems fine because the people get relief, at least temporarily. But what it tells us is that the major signs and symptoms that they're seeing are not due strictly to the infection. They're due to the immune responses against the infection that get sidetracked and end up responding against one's own cells, becoming an autoimmune response. And so that's the thing that picks up again if the infections aren't treated. And so it's, again, a problem that we need to directly address. We can't run away from it.
And when you do address the infections, because you've clearly treated quite a number of people with your protocol, and the infection's treated, and then do you see this whole autoimmune process just back down and people just no longer have the disease, they go into remission? Is that what you would see?
Well, that is one of the things that can happen. Again, these are multiple problems that these people have, but that's one of the things that we've seen with autoimmune diseases. For example, rheumatoid arthritis. And there are actually well-controlled clinical trials that have studied the role of this type of infection in rheumatoid arthritis, one of the few autoimmune diseases where it's actually been well-documented, well-studied, and well-controlled trials done, where people not only found relief, but they found long-term relief, which is something that we haven't really discussed, where you put these infections, you suppress them to the point where they're not really causing a problem anymore. People always ask me, do you ever get rid of these infections once you have them? And that's a big question mark. I don't think you ever do get rid of them completely. And that presents a problem because that means you better remain healthy for the rest of your life or they'll rear their ugly head again sometime in the future and cause problems. And this is exactly what we've seen with people, even people that have completely recovered from these infections, have got their health back and so on. And then they get into, let's say, an automobile accident. They have severe trauma and they're immune suppressed and so on, and then all of a sudden everything starts to slowly come back again. Like you said, within 1 to 3 months, they're right back where they started from, and so that's, again, a problem. They have to start all over again and retreat it all over again.
Yeah, that's, again, this thing is just such a persistent infection, and it just sounds like it's so difficult to eradicate from the body completely. So at the best, it sounds like you can eradicate some of it and then it goes dormant. But certainly all the people that I've interviewed have talked about the onset of autoimmune disease being precipitated by a big stress factor like an automobile accident or a divorce, can be something just primarily emotional, and then an infection that never resolves, like they get exposed to somebody with pneumonia or bronchitis or whatever, they have something come upon them, but it never resolves. They can't ever completely get rid of it. So it seems like those two things combined, I have found repeatedly, and again, this is anecdotal. These are interviews that I've done with a number of autoimmune patients, but they all seem to have the same pattern of the 1-2 punch, and then all of a sudden they're stuck with this horrible, horrible disease. But we're going to take another break, and for anybody else who has a question in the chat room, continue to type out your questions and also call in 646-478-0828. Again, that's 646-478-0828. And stay tuned. We will be right back.
Sometimes life can be a challenge. Would you like insight and guidance to help you make the best choices right now? Contact Helene at angelslighthouse.com to make your personal appointment for a psychic reading or energy alignment. Helene is a direct channel to the angelic realm and is remarkably capable of connecting to the living as well as to your loved ones on the other side. Helene is available to clients all over the world via phone or Skype, and it's simple to set up a group reading anywhere. Visit angelslighthouse.com, where you'll find an easy way to schedule right online. And while you're there, sign up for the Angels Lighthouse newsletter and receive information on all the free energy circles, giveaways, and jewelry with a message. Visit angelslighthouse.com and contact Helene today.
Your property tax bill. Have you seen it lately? It's frightening. Your property taxes are going up while your home value is going down. It's time to fight back and win. For the real truth about the property tax system, get Attorney Pat Quintilian's book, Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out, and How to Fix It. Attorney Quintilian answers all your questions and gives you the facts you need to fight a property tax bill that is spiraling out of control. You'll also read about what happens to property owners who don't check their property records, only to find out too late they're taxed on square footage, fixtures, and even buildings that they don't own. Is this happening to you? Learn your rights. Buy Attorney Pat Quintilian's book today. Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Available on Amazon.com.
Welcome back, everybody. We are going to continue this fascinating discussion with Dr. Garth Nicholson. Dr. Nicholson is the author of Project Daylily, and you can read more about all of this information on autoimmune disease and Gulf War syndrome and vaccinations at his website, which is imed.org. And we've got lots of questions now in the chat room for you, Dr. Nicholson. So, oh my goodness. Let's see. Where do we start? There's just so many questions all of a sudden. First of all, let me just explain something to everybody before I start firing questions at you. I call this the zombie plague. That's my name for it. And the reason is, as a patient, I know what it feels like. And that's how it feels to me. It feels like I'm a zombie some of the time, if not all the time, when this disease is in just going full speed ahead. The other thing is, as you describe the mycoplasma and the effect it has on the cell, it's basically tearing the cell apart. That's also how it feels. It feels like all these cells just have holes ripped in them, and you just feel your energy draining away. So that's not Dr. Nicholson's name for what's going on. It's my name. I call it the zombie plague. So I see this very clearly from the perspective of somebody who has suffered with this for the last 7 years. And, again, the people that I've spoken with, which are very numerous and throughout the world, are describing the same exact thing. So I just want to be very clear about that. And also, let's see, we've got all of these questions. Oh, my goodness. Okay, Lyme disease. Was this bioengineered? That's a question, because of what was going on in Plum Island. I know there was a book written about all of the experiments and how the deer swam from the island with the ticks to Lyme, Connecticut. So do you have any information about that?
Well, not directly. There are a lot of theories about this, and it does seem very suspicious. Here was a laboratory on an island run by the United States Agricultural Department, but also the Department of Defense had a role in it as well. They were conducting experiments, even open-air experiments, involving insect vectors, and some of those were tick and flea vectors. And I don't think it's a problem of a deer swimming across to Connecticut. I don't think that's very unlikely. What is more likely is that birds landing on the island can pick up fleas, ticks, other things, and carry them, and that's on the flyway to Old Lyme, Connecticut. And so it's certainly possible that the first outbreak that was not the first outbreak, but the first community outbreak was recorded in Old Lyme, Connecticut, which is right on the flyway from Plum Island. But before that outbreak was ever studied, there were outbreaks on Long Island that were associated, and may have been associated with the laboratory on Plum Island as well. So it's something that evolved with the experiments at the same time on Plum Island, and so it's very suspicious. We knew some of the things that they were doing on Plum Island, and they were actually looking at these types of infections and doing, in some cases, even open-air testing on the island because they thought everything was contained, but they didn't really think too much about the birds flying back and forth, and that was a problem. So there are whole books that are written on this subject about the suspicious behavior, some of the experiments and so on Plum Island, but I'm not going to get involved in that because I don't have direct knowledge of it, and there are people that have much more adequately dealt with that problem than I have. But it is very suspicious.
Yes, exactly. Okay, well, thank you for that, for answering that question. And here's another one. They wanted to know about the effectiveness or lack of some of these antibiotics that they, like, for example, penicillin. Is that considered an antibiotic that is no longer as effective as it used to be?
Well, it's certainly not effective at all against these intracellular bacteria because they don't have the type of cell wall around it that penicillin attacks. And so they're not susceptible at all to various penicillin and a variety of other antibiotics as well. So for those types of infections, we have to go to what are called anti-metabolite types of antibiotics that go after very specific enzyme reactions inside the bacteria that are unique to the bacteria, protein synthesis machinery that's unique to the bacteria, not to our mammalian cells and so on. So that's the type of strategy that's taken. But unfortunately, a lot of these infections, the mycoplasma among them, once they get inside the cells, some of the time that they spend inside the cells, they're quiescent. They're metabolically inactive. They're not susceptible to antibiotics. So that's one of the major problems, is they have these persistent phases where they're not sensitive at all to attack by antibiotics. So that means that either we have to stimulate these things to be active or find other ways to eliminate them. The immune system, you'd think, might be a good way to do this, but it's not because of reasons we discussed before. that these sometimes carry host antigens along with them when they escape from the cell, and they can cause an autoimmune response as well. So that may not be the best approach either. So we're struggling to find ways to really totally suppress these, but antibiotics remain one of the best bets. But because these are very slow-growing, not very active types of infections, it takes a long-term treatment course of antibiotics to have any effect at all. And that's one thing that argues against mainstream medicine, where they claim that, well, you know, a few weeks antibiotic treatment is really all you need. And that's not true at all with these types of infections.
Well, and now, and also, as you mentioned, you have to use certain antibiotics to be effective against the mycoplasma infections. And those would be what? That would be doxycycline, minocycline?
Well, the tetracyclines are effective. There are other things like azithromycin and so on. If people go on our website and go to a section on treatment considerations, there are documents there that explain the types of treatments, not only antibiotics, and what we call antimicrobial treatments, but also other more natural treatments that are beneficial as well. The natural treatments not only repair the damage, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in the natural medicine part of this next hour, but also things that will naturally help suppress these infections. And so we take a fairly broad view of these sorts of problems that not only traditional medicine, but also alternative medicine approaches are sometimes very useful, and we use them in conjunction. We don't use them one or the other. We found the best way to approach this is to combine them and use whatever works, and that's our philosophy.
I think it's a great philosophy, Dr. Nicholson. I mean, that just sounds like a philosophy that has, you know, outcome as more important than theory, and I certainly appreciate that. Now, here's another question from the chat room. People would like to know, are you finding that, is there anybody that has an immunity to mycoplasma, a natural immunity to this?
Well, we don't know. Again, these are infections that hide inside our cells, so they're naturally sequestered away from the immune system. And the only time the immune system really sees these infections is when they pop out of cells. And that only happens some of the time, and it only happens when somebody is really in an acute phase of the illness where they're having the most severe signs and symptoms possible. And the reason that they have many of those signs and symptoms is because the immune system tried to respond against the exposed intracellular bacterial infection, mycoplasma being one of them, but there are also others that we know can also cause these same problems and overlapping signs and symptoms with the mycoplasma. So it's a problem, and it's a problem which is difficult to approach.
Well, it is, and of course, one of the biggest issues, and you've mentioned this, with all of these autoimmune diseases is chronic fatigue, and I don't think people really understand what that means until they've had it, until they've experienced it. I mean, it's the kind of, what I call a crushing fatigue. It's the kind of fatigue where you don't know where you're going to get the energy to put one foot in front of the other. Because I know people that say, oh, yeah, I know you're tired. I'm tired, too. I had a long day. No, it's not that kind of fatigue. It's quite different.
No, it is quite different, and this is fatigue that is not refreshed by sleep. Now, normally, a person can get tired because of physical activity, for example, and they can sleep, and then they'll recover, and then they'll go on, they'll be fine. But sleep does not cause you to recover from this type of fatigue. This type of fatigue is unrelenting. It's constant. It not only involves fatigue in terms of the physical sense, but also involves mental fatigue as well. It involves brain fog, cognitive decay, a sensory decline. So we see people, for example, that now all of a sudden have visual problems, they have hearing problems, they have all kinds of other things as well as with their decline. And, you know, this is something that we're trying to address. And one of the things that we found, and this gets more on the area of natural medicine, is what causes this severe fatigue. And one of the things that causes it is that inside each of our cells, we have little batteries called mitochondria that produce the energy that we need to function. And there are certain cell systems, like in the central nervous system in the brain, these are incredibly important because if they're not firing and if they're not producing the high energy molecules necessary, all kinds of problems occur, mental problems, memory problems, perception problems, all kinds of different difficulties occur. So we've been going back to studying the mitochondria, the little batteries, and we've found that these are damaged very significantly by these intracellular bacterial infections. And so we've looked at ways in which we can repair that damage. And one of the things that is most damaged are the membranes of the mitochondria. So the mitochondria are surrounded by their own membranes. You can think of it as kind of like the insulation around a battery that protects the battery from running down. Well, if the membrane gets damaged, the membrane of the mitochondria become leaky, just like if you damage the insulation around a battery and it becomes leaky, the battery runs down. Well, same thing with the mitochondria. You damage the membrane, and then they become leaky, and they can't produce the energy necessary for cellular function. And so we've looked at the membranes of the mitochondria, and we figured out what's happening. How are they damaged? How are things like the mycoplasma damaging the membrane? And so, you know, in some cases we can prevent that, but one of the best ways to circumvent that is to repair the membrane as it's being damaged, or if it's damaged, to repair it to allow recovery of the mitochondria. And so we've gone into using natural medicine to naturally repair the membrane, because we have natural ways of doing this, but they're just not adequate enough to deal with the infection. And so what we do is we stimulate the whole process of mitochondrial repair, and we do that by feeding these precursors of the mitochondrial membrane and other cellular membranes as well to help repair it and help remove the damage to the membranes, and then put in molecules that aren't damaged, and this allows the mitochondria to function. And we've done this with, for example, chronic fatigue syndrome patients. So these are patients that have had fatigue for a long time. It's unrelenting fatigue. They can't reverse this fatigue by sleep or by medicines or whatever. But we've been able to repair their mitochondria, and guess what? We've seen 40, 45, 50% recovery in their mitochondria, and fatigue levels go down. They have more energy. They're able to function. And along with that, all of a sudden their memory seems to come back, and they have less problems with short-term memory loss, with brain fog, cognitive difficulties, and so on, because their mitochondria are so especially important in the brain in terms of supplying energy, because our brain cells, our nerve cells in our brains use a tremendous amount of energy, and if the mitochondria aren't functioning at peak levels, then all that deteriorates very quickly.
And now, could you tell us a little more about the product? Because I know the product is NT Factor. Is that correct, the name of it?
Yes, that's the product. These are all natural. It's a supplement that repairs the phospholipids, which are the important building block of the membranes of the mitochondria and other cell membranes as well. And we supply these in a form that can be quickly utilized, quickly taken up by the body and shuttled into the mitochondria and used to repair the damage that's in the mitochondria. So that's the difference between this and a lot of other supplements that people claim repair mitochondria, because they really don't. But this does.
Yes, it works. I've used it. And so I can tell everybody that's listening tonight, NT Factor does work. So if you have chronic fatigue or any of these autoimmune diseases that has that chronic fatigue component, this is a great supplement. And again, I love the fact that it's natural. It's an all-natural product, and it works extremely well. So at least you can bring yourself to some level of function with NT Factor so that you don't feel totally exhausted and all the time. So it works beautifully.
Well, fatigue
and it comes
is
in a powder.
Yes, it comes in a variety of different forms. But fatigue is the number one complaint of patients that are seeking general medical care. So we know that this is a problem that's everywhere. It's a systemic problem of all patients with chronic illness. And so by giving this oral supplement, which is an all-natural thing, it's completely safe. It has no side effects or no downside to it at all, because it's basically just replacing things that are in our body right now. So it's not a drug. It's just a natural replacement of natural molecules that are already present. It's just that they're being damaged at a high rate, and they need to be replaced. So we supply this. It comes in a number of different forms. It comes as capsules, as pills, as powders, and so on, different mixtures with vitamins and minerals, or different mixtures with other things as well. But basically, the really primary building block is called NT Factor, and it's just strictly membrane phospholipids but they're protected, so they're not damaged, because these lipids are very sensitive, and so we have to protect them. So we have a number of ways of protecting them so they can be an oral supplement, so they don't have to be given intravenously or whatever. So this oral supplement that I take and a lot of people take every day now helps restore your mitochondrial function. So we've run 9 clinical trials now on this, and all of them have been very successful.
Yeah.
And all these clinical trials, the results have all been published in medical journals. And so obviously if they've been published, we wouldn't publish them if we didn't have good results. So in all these different trials, we've used everything from cancer patients to chronic fatigue syndrome patients to Lyme patients as the latest clinical trial, for example, patients with other types of diseases, autoimmune diseases, for example. And all these patients benefited tremendously from the use of NT factor, this all-natural supplement. So this is something that I actually just spoke on this topic in Australia when I was there. A tremendous enthusiasm among the naturopathic physicians that they're looking for things like this that are all-natural that can help people with the chronic illnesses. And this is something we're very, very excited about. We've had tremendous results with it.
Well, I'm excited as well, because there is very little that I've found in 7 years. And believe me, my husband will tell you with no happiness at all, I've spent a ton of money looking for natural things that work. This is one of the things that really does work. So
there's good science behind it. When we talk about natural medicine, one of the things that's often lacking in natural medicine is the scientific support. The support of real good clinical trials to actually back up the claims. Now, people are very confused about natural medicine because of all the claims out there. That claims this, claims that. This will do wonders. But very few of them are backed up by science. And this is one of the products that are out there now on the market that's actually backed by scientific studies and clinical trials. And so that's something that people should know, that we're not just blowing smoke or hot air here. This is something that is really solid and is backed by a number of different clinical studies.
And what I also found interesting is that it really seemed to make the biggest difference for people who had severe chronic fatigue.
That's right. That's exactly what we found. And if you look at fatigue, one of the things that we did was we studied fatigue in various forms in various types of patients. And what we found was that in many cases, mild fatigue can be caused by other situations. For example, depression is one of the most common reasons for mild fatigue. Of course, depression, that's a situation, a psychological situation that, you can't repair your mitochondria and reverse that because it's not based on that. But what we found is that moderate to severe fatigue, this is what is susceptible to reduction by things like NT factor, because there the mitochondria are directly involved. And we can actually monitor this. And we've done, in some of our studies, we've actually been able to take the mitochondria and see if they're producing high-energy molecules, to see if their membranes are protected or not. And so when we see when their membranes are protected and they've got the polarity of their membranes, the chemical potential across the membrane is right, they're producing high-energy molecules at a very high rate. If it deteriorates, that goes down. In chronic illness patients, they lose about half of their mitochondrial function, and we can measure that. And yet, if they put them on NT factor, they'll see about a 50% recovery of that. So we know it works. We know it works. Even severe clinical cases, it actually works better. So that's something that we've studied and published, and we're very confident of the results.
It's excellent. And then are there any other natural remedies that you have tested or that you're about to test? I've heard a lot about intravenous vitamin C, different things like that.
Well, we tend to shy away from the intravenous treatments because these all have to be done in a physician setting, and we're all into empowering people to help themselves. And so we're looking for oral supplements, things that people can do themselves to help better their health situation. So there are different vitamin mixtures that are helpful to people. They're not as helpful as the NT factor in terms of fatigue. In fact, we do make mixtures of these different things available with NT factor. And if people are interested in looking at this, they can go to a website, ntfactor.com, And there are a number of different products on that website, for example, some which contain vitamins and minerals and some which are just NT-Factor alone. And they have different combinations of different things that to help people. And we've also looked at that. If you go on our website, we've looked at not only things like NT-Factor and other supplements, but we've looked at ways to recover your immune system, for example, or ways to naturally treat some of these infections. There are some natural herbs and supplements that help. They're no panacea, but they do help. But in general, we find that these have to be combined with antibiotics and other more direct ways of suppressing the infection. So there are different approaches that can be taken with this, and we don't care what the approach is. We just want something that works. And so if you go on our website, you'll see all these different combinations of different things that you can use. And we always tell patients that, you know, no one can predict your outcome on the basis of what you do when you use supplement A or supplement B or treatment A or treatment B. In many cases, you just have to try it because your genetic makeup is different, your immune system is different, your background, your exposures are different, the infections you carry may be different from other patients. And so there are different combinations of these different things that will be useful for you that may not be as helpful for another patient. So some of these things we just have to try and see if they work. And I know that doesn't really sound terrific to somebody who's really sick, but that's the reality of the situation. We just can't do the genetic workup, the environmental workup, and all these other things that would be necessary to define a patient in their environment. And so sometimes we just have to say, well, you have to try some of these things and see if they work.
Exactly. And, yeah, I've certainly tried a lot of things. and I encourage people to...
Well, unfortunately, most of the things you probably tried didn't work.
Yeah, a lot of things didn't work all that great, and there were some things that actually were good, like NT-Factor, you know, that worked pretty well. But the other thing that I find with, and maybe this is my imagination, but having lived with this for a period of years, I swear it feels to me like this mycoplasma is intelligent, which is kind of scary. But it does seem like it adapts and it changes, and it seems, for example, that I can take a certain supplement, and I've heard this from other people too. You'll take a certain thing like pine oil or something like that, and it seems to work for a while, and then all of a sudden it's not working anymore. And
well, that's we've seen that. I don't know how many times people have asked me about this, but that's true of things like the mycoplasma. They're very adaptable little organisms, and they've survived for millions and millions of years because of that, their ability to adapt to changing situations. So, they're very wily little infections, and it takes a lot to successfully treat them. But they can be treated. It just is very difficult and takes a long time.
Well, I hear you. And we have a couple of callers here. I want to get them on the line to speak with you. And we have Derek from Portsmouth, UK. So let me bring Derek on the air. Hi, Derek. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question for Dr. Nicholson?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Hello, Dr. Nicholson.
I hear you.
Yeah, hello. I'd like to know if you've ever tried placebo effects on your patients or anything to do with that. And if you have, what sort of results have you had?
Well, we have. In some of the controlled clinical trials, they receive placebo. And one of the trials that we've run that I like the best is called a crossover trial. That's where the same patient receives either placebo or the test substance, but they don't know when they're going to get it. And we've seen very dramatic results with NT-Factor versus placebo. And is there a placebo effect? Yeah, but the placebo effect is generally 5% or less than 10% of the effect. But then we see 50% effect with the NT-Factor, so that tells you that is working, it's real, it's not a placebo effect.
Okay, but you are getting some results from the placebo. Not major results, but it works on some people, yeah?
Yeah, very minor results, I would say, and inconsistent results.
Okay, well, that's me then. Thank you very much. Thank you for talking to me, Dr. Nicholson.
Sure.
Thank you, Derek, for your call. We really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now, let's see, we've got Jim from Marietta. Let me bring him on the line. Jim has a question for you about immune jump starters. Jim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much, Patricia. Hi, Dr. Nicholson. How are you?
Well, hi. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm wondering about immune jump starters such as a turkey tail mushroom, the Coriolis mushroom, and also there's another one called the Carnivora that's from the one of 17 varieties of the Venus flytrap.
Right. You know, there are a whole bunch of these different, we call them immune boosters.
Yeah.
But jump starter, that would be a good name for it too, to stimulate your immune system and get it going again.
Right.
And, again, we've found that these things are very personal-oriented. That is, they work really well with some people. They don't work at all with other people. So it's just something that you have to try to see in your system whether it works or not. But there are a whole bunch of these. Some of them are listed on our website as well. There are different things that we've used, like transfer factor, for example, very successfully. And there is a transfer factor for mycoplasma, by the way. So these things are very, very helpful, we found. But, again, the brand is very important. The laboratory that made it is very important. Some is junk. Some is very good. And a lot of it is just sort of in between. So it's just something you have to try.
Can you explain where the transfer factor from where that is derived? Is that a natural derivative of a plant or some type of animal species?
That's actually derived from an animal that's responded, their immune system has responded to the infection. And a very popular source, for example, are cows that they immunize with the animals. They extract the transfer factor from the blood, and then this is put into, you know, capsules generally from the milk or the blood, either one. The most common thing for the transfer factor is colostrum, which is the milk from the cow. And these are found in the colostrum, and that's used as a stimulant, immune stimulant.
And so you're saying, too, that this may be effective against infective scleroderma.
It could be. And, again, you know, it just depends on the individual, the type of infection
right.
that's involved and so on. But something like scleroderma, these intracellular bacterial infections are very common in scleroderma. So it's likely that something like this might be helpful. Or the more traditional ways of treating it as well. And we've, you know, always combined a lot of these different things because they really work on completely different mechanisms, so they're not counterindicated, like using two different drugs, for example, that might, you know, might cross the effects and have differing effects that are undesirable. But generally, these things operate at such different level that they're not going to interfere with some of the more traditional treatments like antibiotics.
Gotcha. So this is more like a trial and error type of approach.
Well, unfortunately, it is because we don't have all the laboratory parameters that we could test people and put them into various categories of what they would respond against and what they don't respond against. And you're just not going to find any place that can do that. So when you start using natural supplements, you just have to try them yourself and see what works best for you.
A very curious question, and this will be my last one, and I won't keep anybody else waiting. I know the United States is a little bit particular about, you know, natural remedies. Is there any way that you can address or talk to about remedies and different procedures that could be helpful that may be carried on in, let's say, Mexico or Latin America or countries overseas? Can you address that at all?
I'm going to avoid that question. I'll tell you why, because there's so many different, there's really so many different bad things that go on in some of these clinics in different places, and they're good things, too. I'm not saying everything is bad and it goes on overseas. There's some very good things that are going on that are not approved for care in the United States. I like to focus on what's available here for people in the U.S.,
and
in the case of natural supplements, what's really effective and what works and what's based on science and good science, and what's not, what's just salesmanship or flim-flam. And so that's why, like, for example, we talked about NT-Factor. That's a science-based, you can call it a remedy, but it's a very natural medicine approach. And those are the things that we like. We like things that really have a reason for working, and they work very effectively, and they're very natural, and generally they're repair and replacement of natural molecules that are already there. So it's something that you're not going to be, it's not going to be toxic. They have little or no toxicity at all. So it's something we have a tremendous safety record with, and that I like a lot.
Well, you know, in closing, I'd like to say that I've had a lot of luck with turmeric with curcumin as a daily supplement. Let's say to help with infections. I find that's helpful.
Well, again, there are a lot of things that are helpful to patients like yourself. And again, there are various degrees of helpfulness. And so what we've tried to do in our instructions to patients is give them a number of different choices to try because we can't and nobody else can tell in advance what's going to be best for them.
Excellent. And that offers help, and that's all we can ask for.
I'm afraid that's about it. If you go in your physician's office, most of them don't want to even talk about supplements, or if they do, they may have one that they sell in their office or something that they prefer. But what we found is that some of the ones that you can actually get yourself are even more effective. But a lot of the really effective things, like NT-Factor, have a whole physician's line that they sell anyway. So often you'll go into a physician's office and you'll see NT-Factor products that the physician themselves are selling to their patients. So this is something that's become very big, particularly out here in the West Coast, as physicians
right.
all carry their various lines of various natural products in their own offices.
Well, I never want to pretend like I know anything about the courses involved in getting an MD in medicine, but I do know, and I've heard through the grapevine, so to speak, that anything about supplements is a very, very limited course offered to doctors. And, of course, when I bring up anything about supplements to nurses and doctors, they look at me like I had three heads. So I avoid that question with them.
Yeah, they shouldn't. But again, it depends on who you're talking to and their background and how they were trained. And most physicians were never trained to deal with natural supplements
yes.
at all.
That's
and
what I've
so
been
they
finding,
don't,
yeah.
They don't want to talk about them and they don't want to deal with them.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Nicholson, and thank you for your research. And I'm enjoying your show tonight. It's very informative. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for
you
for your comments.
Yeah, thank you for your call and all your great questions.
Okay, you're most welcome. Good night now.
So Dr. Nicholson is just, I see that we are, got about another 20 minutes here, and I have so many more questions here. It's a very active chat room tonight and people on the phone, and, of course, I have more questions for you and things to bring up, one of them about Alzheimer's, because I know that's a big question here in the chat room again tonight. What is the relationship with mycoplasma and Alzheimer's? Is there one that you could identify for people tonight?
Well, this is pretty preliminary, but we're certainly finding in patients that have early onset Alzheimer's, and particularly rapidly progressing Alzheimer's, that they're certainly at risk for these types of infections, and this is what we've found. So for the patients that are very slowly evolving with Alzheimer's, this may or may not be a factor, but certainly the patients that are progressing very rapidly, just like we found for the cancer patients, that this could be a reason for the rapid progression. And we do know that it does attack the brain, and it does cause these problems within the brain, particularly the energy source in the brain, the mitochondria, but also other things as well in the brain are damaged by the mycoplasma. So it contributes to that process.
So, again, you're not sure if it's a chicken or egg scenario. It's like, does that start the process in motion? You're saying you're sure that what it is quite capable of doing is speeding up the process of the disease.
Correct. We don't know if it's directly involved. There's also a genetic aspect of this disease process. We don't know whether it could be involved in starting it. Even with the ALS patients, for example, we're pretty sure in the case of the Gulf War patients that that's what started it. But they probably had a genetic predisposition to it all along, because that's probably why they were the ones that came down with ALS and not some other difficulty, another problem. So we do think that there's a genetic makeup that seems to be unique for these types of patients. Multiple genes are involved, so it's not something that's simple. But we feel that this is a factor that we know can be involved in progression. We're less sure about its being involved in the actual inception of the disease process and actually triggering the disease process.
I see. And then what about, here's another question that's come up about diet. I know that Dr. Terry Walls has, who was diagnosed with MS, claims that she was able to change her diet and stay on a paleo diet, away from carbohydrates, and that made a big difference in her health. Have you done
any
work with diet?
Well, yes, we have. In fact, I have a number of dietary recommendations, and again, people can find that on the website. But that's an absolute, is that people have to stay away from processed sugar as much as possible. That's really damaging to your system. But there are also a number of other dietary recommendations. And again, they can find that on our website. We really don't have time in the minutes remaining here to go through that. But diet is very important. And one of the first things that we counsel patients on when they contact us is to straighten up their diet, because if they don't correct their diet, they're probably not going to get well. So it's something that you have to do.
And sugars, that's becoming more and more a topic of conversation, that we all need to stay away from that, processed sugars. But carbohydrates, too, because carbohydrates seem to have an intricate connection here between the bacteria and the growth of it and the mycoplasma. Is that something you found?
Yes, that's correct. Although it's easier to make the case with the processed sugars than it is with complex carbohydrates, for example. So I would say that certainly the complex carbohydrates are a lesser evil compared to the processed sugars. That's the processed sugar you should just treat as poison. Patients that have chronic illness should be avoiding processed sugar at all costs. Complex carbohydrates, they can probably reduce those a bit in their diet, but they're not nearly as damaging as the processed sugar.
And you're talking about, when you talk about processed sugar, just so everybody knows what that is, you're talking about white sugar in a powder form or in a granulated form? That's what you're talking
about?
Yes.
Okay. And sugar in products, in various sugars, everything from high fructose corn syrup, for example, to table sugar, sucrose, all these forms of sugar are really bad for you. Actually, they promote obesity, they promote heart disease, they promote a number of different problems, chronic illness problems with people, and so they're really not good. We get enough of the sugars in a regular diet without added sugar, so we don't need to add sugars to our diet.
That's for sure. And what about these other sugars that they're hyping now, and you see them advertised all the time, like Splenda?
Well, those aren't sugars at all. Something like Splenda, for example, is an amino acid, the diamino acid combination that gives a sweetness. And there are a number of different formulations of sugars that are blocked because they've put certain chemical components on them, so they can't be treated enzymatically like regular sugar, but they do have sweetness. So there are a number of different things that have been used as sugar substitutes. And again, people are just going to have to try these and see what works best for them.
Right. And now here's another question, and this is another hot button for people, and especially parents today that are being told they need to have their children vaccinated. But you have found, as well as other researchers have found, that there's mycoplasma in these vaccines.
Well, that's true. And it's not that I'm anti-vaccine, by the way, because we have a whole department at our institute that works on the development of new molecular vaccines. So it's not that I'm against vaccines. I'm just against the way that they're being used today and the sources of some of the vaccines and how they're being prepared. That I am against. And I have really been a strong, outspoken opponent of vaccine scheduling, where a bunch of vaccines are given all at once, or they're truncated vaccine schedules, so they're all compressed into very short time periods. Particularly with young people whose immune systems are just developing, this can be disastrous to their immune systems. And also, I'm really pushing now that vaccines need to be tested for things like mycoplasma, because there's one study in the literature that shows that 6% of commercial vaccines are contaminated with mycoplasmas, and they never test for it. The vaccine manufacturers, and they're making routine vaccines, never test for something like mycoplasma. So this is something I think we do need to check. We do need to test for, and we do need to remove vaccine lots that contain contamination with mycoplasma.
So parents can understand this and that they have a choice. They could bring their child in for a vaccine and say to the pediatrician, I do not want my child to have 6 vaccines at once.
That's correct.
So I want my child to have 1 vaccine, and then I'll bring them in another, 2, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever, for the next one, and that would be a little more reasonable.
That's absolutely correct. But see, to make it easier for the pediatricians, they're putting these vaccines together, these multivalent vaccines, they've put a whole bunch of them together into one shot, and that makes it very easy to administer, but it's not so easy on the patient. It's not so easy on these young children. And the fact that they're now trying to immunize as early as possible, even newborns, I think that's absolutely crazy. You know, a newborn, if it gets, particularly if it gets mother's milk, will be getting a natural immune process already, and they don't need to have, they don't need to be vaccinated when their immune systems are so fragile. And so, as they slowly develop, they're then more capable of handling and dealing with the vaccines. But giving them all at once is a problem, just like we found with the veterans. Giving a bunch of vaccines in a 20 to 30 in a 3-day period was devastating for a lot of these adults in very good health. They were young adults, but it devastated their immune systems. And so you can imagine what it can do to children. And so that's one of the things that we really harp on.
It's frightening what it can do to children. And now I know that you've also been able to make some type of connection between these vaccinations and autism, Asperger syndrome, things like that.
Well, it's not that we've made the connection with the vaccinations. What we've done is we've gone to groups of patients in certain areas where there's a very high incidence of autism. And one of the counties, for example, we studied in California was San Luis Obispo County, where there's it's a central California county that's a very high incidence of autism. When we tested the children there, we found a very high incidence of not only mycoplasma, but other infections as well, like a herpes virus infection and so on. So they had these infections at a much higher rate than we see in the normal population of healthy children. So we know it's damaging their systems, and we know that in the case of the mycoplasma that gets inside the brain causes problems in the developing brain. So we know that that's an issue there that is a very important issue. So these are problems that we really are going to have to address as a society. We just can't continue going on the way we're doing.
Absolutely. And I also want to mention that the same vaccination issues do also apply with dogs and cats, because I know for my dogs, I absolutely refuse to have them vaccinated with more than one vaccine at a time. And I've heard terrible horror stories about dogs, puppies that have been vaccinated with 3 or 4 or 5 vaccines at one time, and it does exactly what you say. It devastates their immune system. So we also need to be cognizant about the fact that it's affecting our pets the same way. And also,
well, you bring up pets, and I'd like to mention one thing here, because one of the things that we did also, because we also do that, is we actually ask questions about if people are ill, if they have, if their pets are ill, you know. And in the case of the Gulf War veterans, that's one of the things that we found, is that they're also, in addition to their children and their spouses getting ill, their pets were also getting ill.
Oh my God.
And their birds were dying, their dogs and cats were getting sick with fatiguing illnesses and so on. They were losing their hair, and just like the veterans, they had some of the same signs and symptoms. So we also had some instructions on how to treat pets that have these infections as well, because it's a very common problem in pets, much more than we'd like to acknowledge. But in particular for people that have Lyme disease, for example, and have pets, their pets could be sick for more than just the fact that they live in a Lyme endemic area and were exposed to ticks just like you were. They could also be sick because you're passing back and forth some of these pathogens. Now, the Borrelia isn't considered to be an airborne infection, but mycoplasma is an airborne infection, and that's why the veterans slowly pass that infection to their children.
Oh.
So they also pass it to their pets. So that's something to consider.
That's fascinating. And so mycoplasma is an airborne infection. Oh, my
goodness.
Yes, it
is.
So
in fact, it's the most common reason for atypical pneumonia in children. And it's also one of the most common problems in, for example, recruits that are being trained. You know, they're going through extensive physical training and so on. It's one of the most common problems for community-acquired pneumonia in recruits is mycoplasma. So you do see it in situations where people are stressed. You do see it in situations where there are other infections that are involved and so on. So, it's a much bigger problem than we've ever thought.
This is huge. This is huge. And if you would, please share your experience. You have a story to tell, which I find wonderful and scary at the same time, where you encountered someone from one of the pharmaceutical companies on a plane and you started talking about vaccinations. Can you share that story with our audience tonight?
Yeah, in a very simple way. I was flying back from Washington and I happened to be sitting next to a person who was very angry because they got bumped from first class back to coach with the rest of us. And so we got to talking. He turned out to be from one of these vaccine manufacturers. And I asked him about this problem with the mycoplasma and the vaccines. And he just didn't want to talk to me about it. He said, you know, are you trying to drive us out of business? That was the response. Instead of saying, well, you know, can you test for these things? And he said, well, yeah, but it would cost us too much money to test for those things. We can't make enough profit on these vaccines if we test for mycoplasma. And therefore, we don't do it. Well, with studies that are in the literature showing that there's a, you know, reasonable percentage of the vaccine lots that are contaminated with mycoplasma, you'd think that they want to find it and remove those lots. No, they just don't want to even think about it.
And that's the sad part of this. I mean, we all know how much money drug companies are making these days. They're making more than a fortune. They're making several fortunes. And to think that they don't care enough about people being vaccinated with mycoplasma along with their flu shot or whatever they're getting, I mean, that to me it speaks poorly of us in general.
You've got to understand who's running these companies now. The major drug companies are not being run by health professionals anymore. They're being run by accountants and bean counters, and they're just interested in the bottom line.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate.
It is, because it's all at our expense, all of this. And it's, again, there's another thing I do want to mention also before the end of the show, because this is a conversation we had briefly some time ago, Dr. Nicholson, about the fact that some of these bioweapon agents that have been released, that there's actually a law on the books that allows the government to release these agents on this population, on all of us, and we have no recourse. I was shocked when we discussed this, but that's the truth. I mean,
it's actually in the book. People can read about it in the book Project Daylily. There's actually a law in the books that allows the testing in the population, open air testing, and all the government has to do is to contact two members of the county who are officials in the county, and it doesn't say what their official position has to be, but if they receive the approval of two officials, they can do it. And it's been done a lot. I mean, we know that there's been something like 120 open-air tests done on the American people that resulted in a lot of casualties, and we just don't know much about these because it's all been covered up.
And even if it was revealed, what we're facing is this public law 10585, which basically says you have no recourse. You're out of luck. You are a human guinea pig for the government at their discretion. And, again, I find that horrifying. What I also find horrifying is there's not more of an outcry about that law and changing that law. That law needs to be changed. We shouldn't
be at
the effect
of that. Well, they've modified it slightly, but it has not been removed from the books. So, unfortunately, it's still there, and we just don't know. I mean, people ask me about this, and I don't know. How could I know? How could I find out? These are classified experiments, so you'd have to have, you know, a fairly high security clearance to even know about them.
Yeah, right there, you're up against a brick wall. So I find this so reprehensible that we could, as a population, be treated this way by our own government. I was talking to my veterinarian the other day, and she mentioned that while she was in school, they had to work with certain bacteria and things like that, and they all had to adhere to a strict safety protocol because they said even though you are working with non-pathogenic bacteria, it can turn pathogenic. And so as a result, you have to adhere to this strict protocol when you're working with these things. So they did. But she mentioned that one of the things they were working with was a fluorescent bacteria. So this kind of thing glowed in the dark. And apparently some branch of the government decided to be a good idea to release this into a river, because then they could see how far it spread because it glowed in the dark. But guess what?
Well, they've done it not only in rivers, they've done it in subways, they've done it on bridges, they've done it, you know, in all kinds of different scenarios where real people were just walking around unknowingly exposed to these types of things. And this has gone on for years, decades.
It's terrible. And then she said, and of course what happened was this non-pathogenic thing turned pathogenic. And she actually said to me, she said, I have, in my heart, what I think what happened, this was the beginning of Legionnaire's disease, this particular bacteria.
Well,
so who knows? Again, it's hard to say.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, I just want to make people aware, because I know that people that listen to our show are very intelligent. They're very interested in their own health and welfare of their families and friends, and they need to know. All of you need to know about this law, and hopefully you will start pounding on the door of your senators and legislators and demand that it be removed from the books so that this can no longer continue. Because, again, I keep looking at mycoplasma as something that is spreading so virulently. And just going back to those experiments that you mentioned in the prisons, and they also took place in the nursing homes, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Well, we know that it took place in a number of nursing homes outside of San Antonio, Texas. But, you know, that was probably just the tip of the iceberg. They probably went, these same types of experiments are probably conducted all over the United States. So,
and again,
these are the ones that we know about, that we had direct evidence of. We had documents proving that they occurred.
Right. So you have to exactly question what the heck is it that we don't know, and I'm almost afraid to hear the answer in that. But I'm sure it would give a lot more information as to why this mycoplasma has gone so virulent. And it's throughout the world. It's not just in the United States, as you mentioned, right?
It's all over now, for sure. And it's penetrating further and further into the population because we're not doing much to stop it.
Exactly. And again, how can we, I guess as patients or as just people, we can start to insist on proper testing and treatment from physicians. But turning their head in that direction is no easy task.
Indeed. I've tried over the years. We keep publishing reviews in very reputable medical journals on these topics and so on. But it's still very difficult. So the information at least is out there. They can find it on our website, download it, take it to their physicians. Whether they read it or not, again, is another matter. But certainly the information is now out there.
Well, it is thanks to you and thanks to your wife also, who deserves tremendous credit for standing up and speaking the truth on all of these issues, Gulf War Syndrome, bioweaponized mycoplasma, and how you found this in vaccines. I mean, all of this you have brought to our attention, and I'm very grateful for all the work that you and your wife have done and continue to do, because this is what we need. We need people of science like you and your wife to be conducting these experiments, to be committed to finding treatments that will work, to being able to think outside the box and say we're not just going to use medication and pharmaceuticals, we're also going to use herbs, or we're also going to use lipid factors. We're going to use whatever works, as you said. That is just so important for all of us who are, if we don't have an autoimmune disease now, I got news for everybody. You may encounter one later or somebody close to you, because the way this spreads, being airborne, there's no stopping it, as you mentioned. There's no stopping this.
Well, the good news is that these types of infections are not very infectious. So it's not something like influenza that's going to spread like an epidemic. This is a very slow epidemic. It's spreading very slowly. And the reason for that is, one of the reasons, is it's just not very infective. So it does take time, takes prolonged contact. And that's what we found with the Gulf War veterans when they came home. They didn't immediately pass it to their family members. It took 6 months to sometimes as much as 2 years before they came down with the disease process. And not all of them came down. The ones that were really healthy and had strong immune systems were able to fight it off. But the ones whose immune systems were compromised or partially compromised, that were not as strong in terms of their health, they were the ones that were susceptible, and they were the ones that probably picked it up slowly as it was being passed.
Yes, and again, that in this stressful society, I mean, who is not without stress? So a stressful incident within a family could have made someone much more liable to get this, to come down with this, or to have this type of an infection. But, you know, my advice to Dr. Nicholson, to everybody who is facing an autoimmune issue today, is to demand that they be tested for these types of infections. And if their rheumatologist will not work with them on this, then find another one and just start putting your foot down. And it's not an easy thing to do when you don't feel well, to be your own advocate. But you have to be, or you have to find somebody to go with you and do it for you. Because if we just accept this traditional medical care that is ignoring mycoplasma infections, guess what? Nobody's going to get any better. So we really have to be willing to take that stand and say, you have to test me for this. Here are the labs that do this test. I want this test. And then I want the treatment. And all that protocol and all the lab listings you said people can get from you via email. Your email
yes.
is on the website, which is immed.org. And again, if you want to read a great book, then please get a copy of Project Daylily. It has incredible information and also your personal journey with your wife in discovering all of this, uncovering all of this, and also putting your lives at risk because you did bring this out in the open. So please, everybody, buy the book, Project Daylily. Go to imed.org, and if you know somebody that has an autoimmune disorder, please give them this information and help them get the right medical care, help them get treatment for these mycoplasma infections. So,
well,
Dr.
that's
Nicholson,
pretty good advice.
Thank you. And thank you so much for coming on the show. I know we're going to have a lot of comments. People are going to want you to come back, and I hope in your busy schedule you can make time for us again. You're just a wealth of information and all the best information is available today. And I thank you on behalf of myself and all of our listening audience tonight, everybody that filled up the chat room. We even had questions we just didn't have time to get to this evening. But again, thank you so much for coming and spending your 2 hours on a Saturday evening with us at Supernatural Girls. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay. Well, good night, everybody, and tune in next week. We're going to have another great show, and have a wonderful rest of your weekend. Good night.
Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another radio adventure with